Thanks for opening up the toolkit. I'm Justin Fortier. I started this podcast to record conversations with people I respect. Since I'm at the beginning of building my career, I want to collect as many tools from others to help in the journey ahead. Over the years, I've had a number of conversations like the one you'll hear today, but often they've been over coffee or some other informal setting. But by putting a bit of extra effort to research and organize questions in advance, record the audio, and publish it across the web, I hope others will be able to benefit. It's currently March 2020, and for these early episodes, I'm doing everything myself, so things are a bit rusty as I learn the challenges of recording audio in person, making theme music, editing episodes, and building an online presence. If you stick with me as a listener, things will improve. If you have suggestions for guests, ideas for the website, or ways I can improve, please email me at justin@toolkit.fm. My website is toolkit.fm. Right now, it's just a simple landing page that will let you sign up for my email list. But by the end of April, it will be fully live and contain episode transcripts, links to things discussed in episodes, as well as short blog posts about what I'm learning in putting a podcast together. Today's guest is Rob McDaniels, a media and technology entrepreneur, investor, and current CEO of Beatport. Beatport is an online store founded in 2004 as the principal source for music for DJs. In an era of streaming, Beatport has actually seen music download sales climb over the last few years. Rob began his career in finance after graduating from Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. He then spent 4 years at Marsh & McLennan in their investment banking and structured finance unit. During his tenure at Marsh, he moved to San Francisco, where he founded InGrooves in 2002. He built this company into a full-service distribution and artist services operation. Under his leadership, InGrooves managed North American digital distribution for Universal Music Group, as well as more than 4 million songs for thousands of artists and labels. As CEO, he grew the company from nothing to $130 million in revenue and nearly 200 employees. Just before becoming Beatport CEO in 2016, McDaniels launched Faction Entertainment, a technology-enabled artist management platform, which he wound down in 2018. I met with Rob in January in his LA office. Being my first interview, I was certainly a bit nervous, but he was super easy to talk to and incredibly gracious, answering my questions around developing conviction to launch a company, building teams, and much more. Without further ado, here's my interview with Rob McDaniels. All right. So when you were transitioning from working at Marsh to wanting to start InGrooves, what made you feel ready to be able to start or be able to make that leap? I know you talked about people weren't necessarily super encouraging from the finance side. How did you get that confidence to make that step?
Well, I think that happens over time. It's a process. I don't remember a specific moment where I had like an epiphany that this is what I need to do differently with my life. I had been passionate about music for a long time in my life, and I wasn't musical or talented in any way. I just had a appreciation for it, and more the business side of it. I'd in college helped friends, or just after college helped friends open up a vinyl record store in Boston. Obviously, when I was in college and in high school before that, I'd learned how to DJ, having spent a lot of time in Europe. So there was just, you know, there was a narrative and a thread through my life that was about music, and I spent 6 years or so after graduating from Trinity and in finance and enjoyed aspects of it, but it wasn't rewarding in a way that felt like it was what I was supposed to do. And so the opportunity arose for me to have the space to develop a concept and an idea. I had moved to San Francisco from New York, and you know, obviously the startup culture there at the end of the first dot-com boom was pervasive, and so it allowed for the entrepreneurial side of, you know, me to come out, and then it's just a whole bunch of luck and hard work. So
yeah, the you described a fortuitous meeting with the CTO of InGrooves, and I wanted to understand how you approach, I guess, creating those fortuitous meetings, because you talked also about developing relationships with the European dance music community in order to start getting those licenses and bring it to the U.S., which, coming from finance and working in securitized risk products, that's a pretty big jump. So how do you kind of position yourself to be able to have those relationships, not being technical or musical?
Well, yeah. So I said it's, you know, it's a combination of hard work and luck.
Yeah.
And I just think that every business that I know, the background and the story of, it's some combination of those two things. So, you know, I think you have to be in the right place in your life. You have to put enough time and thought into what it is you're going to do. You have to think. I always encourage entrepreneurs to think without the blinders on. Like, a lot of entrepreneurs get hyper-focused on their product and why it's going to be the next best thing without thinking about all of the other pieces of the ecosystem that need to be in alignment to support what your idea is. Because inevitably, you can't just release a product in a vacuum. There has to be, you know, the rest of culture needs to be in lockstep with you. You can be ahead of the curve, first to market, but everything has to be ready, right? That's why, you know, if Netflix had launched 10 years earlier, you know, bandwidth wouldn't have been ready for to handle the, you know, the volume at scale. So what was the question? It's late in the day, so I lost my train of thought.
Yeah, that's okay. I actually want to jump off talking about the ecosystem and that needing to be right. So when you're noticing something, whether it's talking with your current customers and you kind of see where the future is headed, but you don't see the ecosystem in place yet, as a leader in the space for a while, is there, I guess, how do you build the ecosystem around you, or like work with other people to drive in that direction? Is that something you're consciously doing, or just conversations with other leaders and things like that?
Well, if you're Elon Musk, you build a whole ecosystem yourself, yeah. Right? And I think that that's a big challenge not many people are up for. So I think that when you're thinking about your business plan and the market opportunity and what the demand's going to be for your product, those are the factors that you have to, you know, what are the dependencies that your product has, your idea? And, you know, those are the challenges or hurdles that you have to put in your business plan, that here's how we're going to resolve it, through partnership or direct investment, or, you know, we're going to start here for the first 2 years until these other things catch up. So I think that just goes into sort of the planning process that you have to go through as an entrepreneur when you're thinking about making the big leap into something new. And again, it's all a process, because you have these ideas, you start bouncing the ideas off of people you trust, you know, you validate those, you pull up comparables, why is your product better? Why is this the right time? Why is there this additional demand? And, you know, then there's, okay, well, now I need to finance it. I can finance it myself for a little while, friends and family. But when you start getting into, you know, smart money, you know, people, angel investors, people who've made money doing this before, they're going to ask you the really tough questions. So if you don't have answers, you're done. Right. I mean, there's all of these steps that exist in the process of starting a company that exist for a reason. Right. And it's because a lot of people have ideas, but not a lot of people can execute them.
Yeah. On execution, when I was looking through your LinkedIn, I saw that you wrote many really strong
recommendations for people. And the way you spoke about them to me showed that you really enjoyed working with them and were able to have great relationships there. How do you, on the front end, prepare by hiring or like developing that talent and getting other people excited to work with you and making sure that, I guess, to get that end result where you're giving this great recommendation saying, hey, this person was fantastic. I hope to hire him again in a different function, something like that. Because that seems like a really strong endorsement. So how do you get to that point? And what are you looking for when you're...
Well, one of the biggest challenges that I've had throughout my career is hiring the right people. I've definitely hired some of the wrong people in the past. So I'm, you know, far from perfect in that respect. I think that, again, this the reality is that you can't act in isolation, operate in isolation. You have to rely on other people. But good people are drawn to good visions for where we're going, and they want to work with people that respect their contribution to the team, that it's not a monolithic enterprise where, you know, it's my way or the highway, and I approach things with very much like almost like the sports mentality, where we're a team, and I'm going to play my role as if I'm the point guard or the rebounder or the head coach or whatever I need to be. That's my role, but I can't be everything, and neither can you. And we all have our talents, and so bringing that all together and unifying those different personalities, embracing them, but unifying them around a single vision that incorporates elements of everybody's background and approach and philosophy and so forth. That's what I've always been able to do, and I don't know why that is what I'm good at, you know. Like, I can sit in a room with a CFO and talk to them about their financial model and ask in reasonably intelligent questions, just like I can with a CMO and their marketing plan, or a CPO and their product plan, or a COO and their HR issues, or, you know, supply chain issues, or CTO and, well, I can't talk about their code, but I can talk about, you know, just how they're approaching, you know, certain problems. But just that's what I've been able to do. And maybe it's my liberal arts education at a place like Trinity, you know, having spent 6 years in finance, learning a lot of different industries and personalities. But that's what I bring to the table.
Yeah. And developing a vision is something, looking through your background, this most recent project you're on at Beatport, to me looked very different than something like InGrooves, where you were the founder, the original idea. But at Beatport, it was started many years before with kind of two cycles of management before you. Coming in, how did you, number one, get excited about the opportunity, and two, begin to build a vision for where Beatport was going to go when you joined on with, you know, integrating with the team and finding out where to go?
Well, Beatport is fairly unique for me in that I was actually there when it was started. So InGrooves was a big supplier of content to Beatport when it launched, because InGrooves started in the dance and electronic genre, signing up artists and labels to distribute them digitally. And so Beatport, obviously focusing on dance electronic music for DJs, we supplied them a lot of content. So I've known the brand, the company, the executives throughout its life. And to me, it was intriguing because I kind of started my music career there. I sort of lived and breathed DJ culture for a while when I was younger. I knew the brand was, you know, a strong brand with a lot of customer loyalty, but had just taken some strategic missteps in the past, you know, 5 or 6 years before I joined. And so it just felt like a very logical, natural fit. And I even, the original founder of Beatport is back. I brought him back to help me. His name's Jonas Temple, and he's back involved with Beatport because, you know, he led the DJ industry through the last transition from CDs to digital. And so now as we transition from digital to streaming for DJs, it's helpful to have his perspective. So, yeah, I mean, it's been a good marriage so far.
Yeah, is getting the direction. You talked about bringing the original founder back in, but did you come in with a sort of vision where you had talked with the Lifestyles, the parent? Is that something that was discussed beforehand, or is it you kind of arrived with, and then the team?
No,
here
I arrived
helped
with an open mind, believing that I could figure it out simply by listening to. I knew enough about the brand to know generally what needed to happen, but I also knew that I could sit there and listen to people that knew a lot more than I did about where the company had been most recently, what the opportunity was, and how best to then build a vision around that. Because at the end of the day, you need people and you need capital to accomplish a vision, right? And so we had to get keep the right people here. We had to hire the right people in to develop and execute the vision that the investors would believe in so that they would provide us the capital we needed to go and execute it. And that's what we're doing now.
I noticed with both companies, Beatport and InGroove, there's this grouping together or a kind of a growing and a consolidation piece with InGroove's acquiring something from Universal, then Universal acquiring it back, and then kind of the restructuring that happened with Lifestyle. Do you see these same trends of like growing and shrinking of companies, and why do you think, or how does size factor into, you know, being able to accomplish a vision? Like you talked about Beatport shrinking down and focusing on DJs. How important to that, or how do you see companies growing, and when is it time to take a next step to branch into something different or to become part of something bigger?
I think the customer dictates that a lot. I mean, I think that the two different stories between InGroove's and Beatport as it relates to that. I mean, InGroove's initially signed Universal as a customer. Universal wanted to use InGroove's as its digital supply chain because we were better at developing scalable, cost-effective software than what a major label could do at that time. They've obviously progressed since then. But they made a strategic investment. And we became a service partner of theirs. There came a point at which they wanted to, the other investors in InGroove's wanted to sell the company. Universal at that point owned about, you know, maybe 20-25%. So they bought the other 70-75% that they didn't own. They were a natural buyer in that situation, right? And I think that that was somewhat always the expectation. With Beatport, you know, it was a bit more of a tumultuous story with Beatport. You know, they'd gone through the typical sort of fundraising process and fast growth company from 2004 till about 2000. When were they sold to? 2012 or 13 to SFX, and you know, that's because, you know, the private equity firm had been in for 5 years and they were ready to exit the business. And, you know, SFX was there rolling up a bunch of companies. And you know, that's a fascinating story in and of itself. You know, Robert Silliman, third time doing a roll up in the music industry. The first time he created Clear Channel, now iHeart. Second time he created Live Nation, basically, right? Rolled up radio stations and then promoters. Third time was not a charm for him. You know, Beatport got wrapped up into that, made some bad strategic decisions dictated by the parent company, and everything went belly up, and, you know, things continued to operate in bankruptcy. But, you know, Lifestyle was what emerged and from the bankruptcy, and, you know, Beatport was able to go back and refocus on its business, and that it needed to do that, right? I mean, you've got this situation where you get influx of capital to grow your business, to try new revenue streams and new products and so forth. Hopefully they work, right? And then you shrink down a little bit to harvest that investment, right, before you expend capital to hire engineers and product development and so forth people. But if you get it all wrong, right, and you're like, shit, this is not going to produce what we thought it was going to produce, and it's costing us more to keep it going, to maintain it, than it is to shut it down, you know, then you go through the more massive contraction process, which is what happened to Beatport before I joined. Yeah. So, you know, now we're in the phase where we're investing in new products and services, and, you know, we're in growth mode, you know, and investors are interested in that because, you know, if you're a growth company, high growth company, you're going to trade at a multiple of revenue. If you're a lower growth company, you know, multiple of EBITDA.
Yeah.
So
with the SFX roll up, you talked about it being dictated not by the customer. So what you do in, I guess, all your work experience where you've, how do you stay connected to a customer, especially a company like Beatport that has so many customers? And how do you know which customers to listen to? Because I'm sure you're being pulled by a lot of different ways with working with artists and DJs, and they all have kind of different ways they want to see your platform go.
Well, you definitely can't make everybody happy, that's for sure. Look, at the end of the day, the customer is dictating, you know, what you should be doing in many respects. You can predict what their behavior is or what the customer wants, right? So for Beatport, you know, it really simplified the DJ workflow, you know, from having to carry CDs to, you know, now being able to load it all onto a USB stick. And now we're introducing a new way to improve their workflow by giving them access to, you know, all of our songs fully integrated with DJ performance software and hardware, you know, bringing streaming to the DJ booth. So at the end of the day, you want to try to create that value for the customer, and you may have different customers that perceive value differently. You can't chase your tail too much, especially in the creative industries. Everybody wants their music in a certain way, shape, or form, or, you know, they think a certain song is techno, not tech house, or you know, progressive house, not you know, whatever, tech house. So, you know, these debates go on all the time, and we shut some of that out. You know, but we also spend a lot of time getting to know our customers, polling them. We do a lot of surveys on the site. We understand not just how our customers interact with our product, but how they interact with other products. So we can build sort of these personality profiles, so we understand their behavior, their purchase behavior. You know, and that's just, I think that's just, you know, knowing your customer is an important part of the business.
Yeah, awesome. I think I'll ask just a few more questions.
Cool.
Here. I'm really interested by the company you started a few years ago, Faction, around management. And for the listeners, I saw it described as technology-enabled management services company that provides a variety of centralized services and technology tools to talent management. And I'm going to kind of vocal. It seemed like you were trying to create a tech-enabled franchise almost for these managers to be able to pull together and quickly set up a business and do a lot of the complicated and mundane things. Why do you think that that wasn't as scalable as maybe you hoped?
I think there's a lot of reasons why that didn't prove out the way that I had expected it to. And I still battle with that every day because I think there's an opportunity to modernize the world of talent management effectively. And, you know, you've got a situation here where, you know, almost every, let's just focus on musician, certainly every career musician, 95% of them have a manager, right? And so what does that mean? What does that manager mean? What do they do? They're effectively the CEO of that entity, of that brand. And yet they've got no CEO training, and they don't necessarily, they're just the guy who was the friend or found the artist or offered to give some, make some connections. And, you know, obviously there's some established managers where, you know, they've proven themselves, and but they also operate very independently of each other. There's not a lot of collaboration between managers, even in organizations that are larger management organizations. It's really just, you know, 10 or 20 independent managers that don't have a lot of interaction between each other, right? So to me, there was also this whole, you know, they didn't necessarily embrace technology and open communication. And, you know, again, this was back then, like Slack would have been very foreign to them, Asana. So really what we were trying to do was to take what became Slack and Asana, but take pieces of that and customize it for the world of management so that managers could become more effective CEOs and communicators and project managers, and therefore their clients would benefit by not having this single point of failure. But the analogy that I've used in the couple of years since we wound that down was, you know, if you had tried to get taxi drivers, like yellow cab taxi drivers, to be the first adopters of Uber, it would have failed, right? And what we did was we tried to get existing managers to become the early adopters of the Faction app and processes. And instead of just being like, hey, let's be patient and wait for all the new managers, you know, or hey, artists, you don't want your old manager, you know, your existing manager, you want a new manager that's a different kind of setup, you're plugging into a different solution. I think I was impatient. And so, you know, we were the fastest growing management company in the first year ever, like signed up 28, 30 managers. But that was just like a get big quick thing. Like they weren't buying into the methodology. So
that's why. That's really helpful to be able to understand. I guess one final question here. Is there any book or resource that you find yourself frequently going back to, or anything that's, I guess, really helped influence your thinking? You talk a lot about paying attention and being able to listen. Is there anything that you'd recommend to read or look at? It doesn't have to be a book, but
yeah, I don't read as much as I should. That's like been a New Year's resolution for the last 10 years. A resource? No. man, you know what? I wish I had like a really profound, intelligent answer for that. And I don't. I like, for me, my life experience, my professional experience, that's what I draw upon. And like, I don't want this to sound obnoxious, but like a lot of times when I read these books about, you know, boardroom battles or starting a company or, you know, going after the big guys or doing, you know, being backstage or whatever, it's like, I don't know, I've done that. Like, I've been there, I've lived it, so I don't really need to read a book to have someone tell me about it. So I just refuse to write a book about it all. Yeah, I just kind of, I draw on my own personal experience. And also, again, I've just learned, I've had the benefit and luck of learning from a lot of people. And so, yeah, I'm just lucky.
Awesome. Well, thank you.
Yeah.
That's great.
Thank you for listening to episode 1 of The Toolkit. I look forward to sharing more episodes with you in the near future.